Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. This week, I sit down with Dr. Betsy Page, a colleague at Kent State University, and we talk about teaching group work, in particular about the components that go into Dr. Page's group work class. With me today is Dr. Betsy Page, and she's an associate professor at Kent State University and a great colleague, a fun person to be with and be around.
Thanks, Marty.
But her area of expertise, which I haven't yet spoken to anybody on Counselor Audio Source about, is group work. And we're a little bit interested in getting some information out for counselor educators and who are working with groups or might find themselves teaching groups. Why don't you tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and how you got interested in working with groups and what kinds of experiences that you might have had that kind of led you up to this place of instructing here at Kent?
Working in groups. Well, as an undergrad, coming out of undergraduate school, I worked probably 15 years as a classroom teacher at different grade levels, which is a lot of groups. And then I was very lucky in my master's program that at the University of Southern Maine that we had good groups, but I had an opportunity to see a number of people that were experts in the field, for example, to work with Peg Carroll in class. And the New England Association for Specialists in Group Work used to have speakers who came and did CEU presentations.
Mm-hmm.
So the more I did those things, the more interested I was in groups. And then when I did my doctoral study at the University of Maine, I worked with Diana Holtz-Kalacki. And that, of course, opened up another whole level of exposure to groups and experts in group work.
Mm-hmm. And this is the area now that you've been at Kent for how many years?
11.
11. Okay, so this is the area. Yeah, we're both shaking our heads. This is the area that is sort of your life's passion, the area that you've started to write in or the area that you've been writing in, and sort of your niche here in teaching at Kent State.
Yes, I was very lucky to come to a place where I could really, every semester, teach the course that most interested me. And so I teach the group work class to the master students every semester, you know, three times a year, however you want to phrase it.
And I think when you first came here, there were also some phenomenal faculty members who also was very interested in a group work, too. So you had some colleagues.
Yes, I was lucky enough to overlap briefly with David Zimpfer.
Okay.
And get another view of group work from talking with him.
All right. Well, I guess we're going to start out and kind of move into some content areas, and then there might be some questions that, for me, emerge in terms of reflection from those content areas. But let's talk about that faculty member who comes in, and it's their first semester, their first opportunity, and they're teaching group work.
Well, one of the things that I would say is this is an exciting class to teach because it's experiential,
mm-hmm.
and the students love that experiential part of it. But I would say as a faculty member or a new faculty member teaching group work for the first time, the one real important piece is your pre-semester planning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably that's true in any course, but being very thoughtful about your syllabus and having things ready for the class. And I thought maybe I'd talk just a little bit about the way I think of it.
In terms of planning?
In terms of how to do that.
Okay.
Most of the time for academic semesters, we have about 15 weeks, so you're looking at planning 15 classes. And most of the time in programs, we know that there is a sole class that carries the weight for instruction and group work, say for the KCREP standards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really quite a bit to do in those 15 classes.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to think of it as, you know, how can I maximize the use of those 15 classes?
Mm-hmm.
And that there's going to be sort of a dance back and forth between experiential work and cognitive learning that integrates into that experiential work.
Okay. So how do you do that dance? What does it look
well,
like?
Well, the dance is sort of, I would describe it, I think of this semester as thirds, although the middle third is much bigger. And in the beginning part, the first, say, 5, maybe 6 weeks of the class, I spend a lot of time doing the things that you would say to your group leaders they should do when they start a new group. Mm-hmm. In other words, making sure that I have a very good first session with the students, making sure that we do things to introduce each other, to get to know names, to get connected, to get everybody participating, so that I'm modeling in that first session and carrying through several sessions all the things that would build group cohesion.
So preparedness, sort of having a structure for those first kind of groups, making sure that people are connected in for the class.
The class, yeah, because yeah. In the same way that we often say, well, new members coming into a group can bring some anxiety with them, I think that's often true for our master students. They don't quite know what to expect in this class, and they may be a little nervous coming in. Mm-hmm. And we need to be mindful of that and not just, you know, gung-ho, where's my objectives? We need to attend to the people coming into the class in the beginning.
So it's interesting. I mean, what's just from talking about the first third and what you're doing in preparing for the class and also creating this first third experience, it's like a parallel process.
Yes.
In a lot of ways.
Are
students aware of what they're experiencing from a classroom structure is also similar to what new group members might experience in a group? Are they aware of the process?
I think I make them aware of it by going back at the end of each class and sort of commenting on, well, what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and how it's related to their readings. Mm-hmm. And they're more able to make those connections after they've gone through 3 or 4 weeks of the readings, and particularly after they read chapters on, well, how do you begin a group?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's a lot of the focus in the first third of the class is helping them think about what a group is and how to start a group. You know, for example, what are group norms? And we do a lot of this in multiple ways. For example, I use videos, and I like to show them multiple models of people starting groups so that they don't have one and only one picture of a group leader and then think, well, I'm not like that person.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to see a number of models of people starting groups, as well as experiencing different groups in different sessions in class.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin to see the commonalities in terms of what has to be done in beginning sessions, but the differences in the personalities and styles of the group leader.
Mm-hmm. So that first group, that first third, sort of sets the framework for the second third. What's going on in the second third?
The second third, or the middle part of the course, we do co-leading of small groups in class.
Okay.
I mean, this is a structure that I learned from Diana Hals-Kalacki, and it works. It's just wonderful. It's the piece that the students cite after the semester as being most helpful to them is actually leading.
Okay. So try and paint a visual picture of that. What does that look like? In that middle third for our listeners?
Well, we plan out a schedule with partners in terms of who's leading what day and so on, and the topics vary to cover a range of topics, but also to sort of match up with what we're reading. If they're reading a chapter on adolescence and school counseling, then the groups that they would prepare would be related to those topics. Or if they're reading a chapter on Gestalt theory, then they might try to show some of the Gestalt concepts in the group.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I would explain, and the way I explain it to students is, these groups are not therapy groups. They're skills training groups.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a list of skills in the syllabus, and that's what I'm looking for them to show in the groups and to practice in the groups.
Why not therapy groups?
Because that would be viewed as ethically problematic.
Oh, okay. It's not therapy groups for the students.
Right.
Okay.
In other words, if I'm a graduate student and I had a recent divorce, I tell you, don't talk about that. We don't want to hear that. We want you to do something where you can be free of any outside emotional stuff and focus on the skills we're trying to learn. Mm-hmm. And one way I keep it focused that way is to have a set list of skills in the syllabus, and the groups know that that's what we want them to show. And when they select their topics, I usually divide the class in half, so they are basically working in two groups, and each group picks out probably 10 topics that they're willing to do a practice group on.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in that group has to agree to do it, and anybody who doesn't want to can veto it. For example, when my mother was in the nursing home, I wouldn't have wanted to have to lead a group on the nursing home. Mm-hmm. That would have been too overwhelming.
Right.
So anybody who's in the group I'm in has a right to say, well, you know, I'd rather not lead on a particular topic.
So it gives the group, that half of the class, some responsibility, but it also allows them some choices at the same time.
It allows them some choices and keeps it in a range that I would think would be safe and appropriate.
Okay. All right. And that's it. You know, I want to continue on with this second third of the class, but you've struck on an issue that I know comes up as sort of a question that many people weigh in on about, should students be experiencing real groups? Should there be some real group experience for them, and the ethics of being involved in doing that in a program?
Well, I find the phrase real group very interesting.
Oh, okay.
Believe me, the groups they do in class are real groups.
Okay.
I think that we've gone back and forth in the profession with ideas that, well, the students have to go outside and find a group and so on. And I strongly take the position that they're better off to do the group in class,
mm-hmm.
where it's instructionally focused,
okay.
and supervised, so that, first of all, we have the sense of safety supervision, and we know what are we getting out of that time for those groups. If we just say, well, you know, you need to have 10 or 12 hours of group experience, I want you to go out in the community and find it, everybody will have an experience, but I don't know that those experiences will be anything alike, or that they will make any common progress towards the goals of learning that we're supposed to have for this course.
So, yeah, you bring up a real valuable point of trying to keep the focus on the fact that the purpose of this course is instructional to some, you know, in teaching them what group structure is like and how that works. I guess let's continue on with the second third.
Okay. What it would look like the day they do the groups, let's talk about that.
Okay.
Was one group would be in sort of a center circle, and that would be the group that was doing the training group, the practice group, and around the outside of them, and this is often called a fishbowl technique, you'll see that phrase in the literature, would be a group that would be observing. Mm-hmm. So the students do about half an hour group, and we've planned that in a class session before we ever come to this. But the students on the outside are looking for those specific group leader skills, and I'll go around and say, well, which one are you watching for? And they might say, you know, mm-hmm. holding the focus.
Mm-hmm.
So when we finish with the group, I usually process a little bit with the co-leaders and then with the members. And then I'll go back to the outside group and say, well, what were you looking for and what did you see?
Mm-hmm.
So it gives our students experience in three different ways. One is co-leading,
mm-hmm.
and one is being a member, and then being an observer of group process.
Okay, all right. And you get some information. I guess the student in sitting in each one of those positions would get a different orientation.
Different view, and different experience.
And learn something from those different experiences, mm-hmm. those reflections. Okay. Is there more about two, or what happens in the third part of the third?
Well, probably the other piece I would say about two is, I usually follow the outside feedback round,
mm-hmm.
with comments on whatever area the group leaders pick. For example, if they decided they do a group on of second graders, I might then spend some time talking about issues that typically come up in working with students at that age.
Oh, okay.
Or if they do a group on divorce, mm-hmm. I might talk some about the typical issues that would come up in a group on divorce and how to and maybe how not to respond to them as a group leader. And I think that helps them integrate some of the readings they have in their broad-based coursework with the idea of what to do in a group.
Okay.
The other thing I would say about the middle section of the course is students often need help with theory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And even if they've had the basic theory class, it's been my experience that they have difficulty picturing how would I do that theory in a group.
Mm.
You know, if I'm going to work with Adlerian theory with an individual, well, that was our basic class and we saw videos and we know how to do that.
Yeah.
But they need you as the instructor to help them visualize and experience, well, what would it be like to do that with a group?
Yeah, to do a lifestyle inventory or to...
Yeah, and you know, I would hold a very, probably a very strong position, and experts in group are sort of all over the range on this, but I do not like to see the leader and an individual kind of working and everybody else watching.
Mm-hmm.
I want the group to be very interactive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the students need help knowing, well, as you say, a lifestyle inventory. Well, how do you have the group, everybody working on that? And then how do you process that?
Yeah. I mean, how do you keep the focus open for people to engage and for crosstalk to occur?
Mm-hmm.
If you're working off an instrument and going one by one, around the circle to deal with it. You know, what are ways in which... So you're saying students need to learn, or the challenge that students have is learning how to take those theoretical models that are often individual based,
mm-hmm.
and shift them into a group work type thinking.
And that, and also they need things pointed out. For example, if we work from Yalom's curative factors in something that's happening in the group really strengthens cohesion, they need you as the instructor to say, well, this piece that just happened right here when so-and-so did this, that was a very strong point in building cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're constantly bridging between what's happening in the groups, mm-hmm. and the readings and the conceptual models they have.
Hmm. Okay. All right. And what about that third section of group work?
That third section sort of overlaps a little bit with the second section, but I look then at the wide range of topics in the KCREP standards, and I say, okay, some of these are covered by chapter readings. Sometimes that's integrated with the groups that we're doing. So when they do those groups, sometimes there's half an hour at the end. So suppose they did two groups and then there's sort of a half an hour of class left. I'll use that half an hour of class left for something one of my principals told me once. She said, teaching is a lot of little lessons.
Hmm.
Well, I'll do a little lesson on something related to one of those KCREP standards.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we sort of finish off with the student groups, I look at some of the other areas that we haven't touched from the standards and maybe give more lecture on that.
Mm-hmm.
In the first two-thirds of the class, I do very little lecturing.
Hmm.
It's as experiential as I can make it.
And that, as you described that first third, I might have been misled to believe that because you're creating the structure, that with that comes lots of content delivery too. But you say you do very little lecturing in the first and first and second third.
The content comes through the videos. It comes through the experiences they have.
Okay.
In other words, if we're looking at Peg Carroll's video on leading in the here and now, I might comment on how she was linking members by insisting that they talk to a person rather than the floor or the ceiling, and then linking that to what did they read in their book chapter.
Yeah, okay.
Or if we're working on group norms,
mm-hmm.
and they've read it, but they don't quite know what to do with it. One of the things I do sometimes is put them in small groups so that I'm working on the topic, but I'm making them be in small groups and work together. Now, one of the things I do is have them be in a group and say, okay, your group of five, needs to come up with a poem, song, or dance that includes all your names so that I'm working the agenda of knowing each other and the norms you want for this class.
Are there other things that happen in that last third of the class?
Yes.
Okay.
One of those would be a thorough going over of the ethical codes.
Okay.
And particularly going over the new codes and the emphasis on screening and going through the codes and saying, okay, many of our students have had other classes, although not all of them. Some of them would have it in the group in the first semester, and saying, these particular points, this is how it would come up in a group. And this is how you think about it in terms of groups.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that. We might do some scenarios about ethical situations. We would do some work on multicultural. Now, what aspect of it might depend? Something that supplements what they've already done in their groups.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if they had a group and it was about race relations, well, I don't know that I'd go back and lecture on that, but I might lecture on gay and lesbian issues. But I would sort of supplement what we've already done. Other things that I do is spend some time talking a great deal about the school setting and how the school setting influences things like confidentiality, permissions that you have to get, the types of groups you should run, and also the type of support you need. And I will also talk with the students about consistency across the purpose of the group, the topic, like suppose it was a group for people who were depressed, and how are they going to structure what happens in the group to address the depression so that we're not having a group for people who are depressed, but we're not doing anything that we would think would reduce any aspect of the depression.
So you go back to maybe the curative factors, and maybe then you also go back to maybe more, I guess, modeling of behaviors or modeling of things that people can address.
Well, I would go back to the symptoms that we add up and call depression.
Okay.
Or and say, okay, well, if it's about depression, then what we're doing in the group, we have to reasonably think would affect decrease one of those symptoms. And that's part of our outcome measure. So that we're planning holistically from the topic all the way through to the outcome measure. I think students have problems with that. They get lost along the way. And the only outcome measure they want to look at is how satisfied I was with the group.
At the end of that group.
At the end of that group.
It was a good night, it was a bad night.
Another approach, and this is often with children, is I want to work on something, but what's going to guide me? Well, what has to guide me is my developmental models.
Oh, okay.
And so talking about how those developmental models might influence the group and the outcomes we were looking for.
And also in terms of what you can expect kids to do at that age in the group.
Yes.
Around a particular topic and how that topic would be handled based on where they are developmentally.
Yes, that a group about, I don't tend to call it divorce, I tend to call it family changes, might be very different for an 8-year-old than a 16-year-old or a 45-year-old.
Right. And I think that's a tough thing. I mean, I'm working with those same sort of developmental concepts in another area. With career and getting students to think about how kids at different ages get different information and it adds up developmentally to more, you know, it fits in their development at the right time in the right place. And often I find students are either trying to overshoot their development or undershoot their development in a lot of areas with that. So I'm glad that that's something you bring into the group work process.
Another thing that I talk to them about in the group is the group class, well, I don't know if it should be unusual, but in some ways it probably is a wonderful opportunity for the master students to build their own support group. They're there. We emphasize getting to know each other. We emphasize working together. And I have seen many students come out of that class and make friendships that would then carry them through their master's program and beyond. Mm-hmm. Another thing I emphasize is that counseling is a leadership position. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have students who talk in a small voice. Their body posture might indicate they weren't that confident. And I will coach for improving that throughout the whole semester so that we get a little bit better presence.
Any other ideas or thoughts about that last third?
One of the things that the students really enjoy, and I'm putting this last for a reason, and the thing they enjoy is some sort of activity fair where they all bring in an activity that they read in the book they really like. Mm-hmm. But we put that towards the end because they need to understand how to structure a single session and a multiple session group and then choose the activities to work towards the purpose of the group rather than take a book and say, well, what's a neat activity to do? And, well, it was a neat activity, but it didn't help the group move anywhere.
Yeah, it sounded exciting, but it really didn't fit in with the objectives.
Yeah. So
you really try to get them to emphasize the objectives, the development, and then pick the
activity. Once we learn what we're doing and we have some leader skills, the library has some excellent books that would give us activities.
Just to say, where is all this leading for you? You've been teaching this for 11 years now, and you know, what kinds of maybe research areas have you become interested in as a result of teaching this? Are there questions out there that you think need to be asked yet? Or what other types of professional work are you doing that leads you, that ties with this group work?
Well, I think one of the things that interests me is the whole idea of the overlap with group work and supervision. The dynamics of groups, group process. And it's tricky because the phrase group and supervision get all mixed up. But let me say it this way. Like if I'm teaching a practicum, as I am this semester, my students sitting there at the table with me, that's a group. And how can I use what I know about group work to make our group process, the group supervision that we do together as we look at students' tapes and we kind of coach each other along about our strengths and what we need to learn, how can I use what I know from group to help that? Another part of group supervision that interests me, I would phrase as supervising students doing groups. I mean, in our practica here, the students all lead groups. They co-lead. And they need the same type of careful supervision for that they would for any other counseling. Mm-hmm. So that's an area of interest to me.
I wonder if maybe you have some reflections on this. If there are aspects of group work that, from your experience of doing supervision, seem to be the key elements of group work that fit in with supervision, or at least your style of supervision?
Building the sense of cohesion.
Okay.
The sense that we're in universality, that we're in this together. We're not all going to counsel the same way or lead groups the same way, but we're going to go forward together and we're going to help each other. Mm-hmm. And learning to give feedback, you know, informative, non-judgmental comments on people's videotapes of their counseling that will help each other grow. And in the beginning, the students are a little hesitant. They kind of look at the other person and go, oh, what should I say? And they learn, partly through instructor modeling, how to phrase some of that feedback so it's helpful to each other.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about that same thing in terms of how much I believe, or I'm thinking of the supervisors I've had. The supervisors that I've had, the ones that were probably the best group leaders, were also, for me, the best supervisors. And that might have been a style that works well. But for those that, you know, that I felt like it was an individual experience that other people were watching, my supervision was an individual experience that other people were watching, probably less for me, less powerful of an experience. So I guess I would like to, I need to think about that more in terms of what you've just shared about how good group work interfaces really strongly with good supervision.
I really think it does. Here our students do 2 semesters of practicum, the community folks do, and 2 semesters of internship. So their peer group probably has a high percentage of overlap for almost 2 years.
Wow.
So the degree to which they can help each other grow is real important.
Well, you've given us a picture inside what goes on in developing a group work class and planning for a group work class, not only for those who are teaching it, but probably for students who are going to take it or have taken group work and get a good idea of you know, how this could be structured and how it works for you. So if you have any additional things to say, any final words?
Just, you know, commit yourself to being a counselor and knowing as much as you can, because it's the good you're going to do for helping people is real important.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks for being with us on Counselor Audio Source.
Thank you very much.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Betsy Page from Kent State University regarding teaching of group work. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.